I've got a California king. Okay, maybe it's a twin bed and some roommates. That's Chapel Roan. I'm Blake Murphy, and this is Jays Talk Plus. The Toronto Blue Jays got a lot of contributions from the roommates yesterday on school picture day. I was down at the Dome nice and early, saw the team taking all their photos, and then the photos with the expanded staff and things like that, which is always a nice thing to see. And then, of course, the players having some fun with it, including the roommates Ernie Clement, Spencer Horwitz, and Davis Schneider having some fun with it. And then having some fun with David Peterson and the New York Mets, as that trio of guys contributed in a fairly major way to a 6-2 victory. You got a pretty big third inning there that started with something we haven't seen a lot of this year, and I missed the Dalton Varsho lefty on lefty drag bunt up the first baseline. He does that to start the inning. Alejandro Kirk comes up with a big RBI double. Ernie Clement gets on. Davis Schneider breaks out of what's been, well, we hope breaks out of, but has a big moment amid what's been an extended slump here. A two-run triple. Then Joey Loperfido would add on there with an RBI single as well. Leo Jimenez got hit by a pitch in there somewhere. He was also, Leo Jimenez is getting hit by a pitch at like a Reed Johnson level here lately. I don't know how many he has on the season, but it feels like once a week or so he's been getting beaned with one, which has, yeah, he's at 13. He's been hit by 13 pitches in 51 games. He got hit by 15 in 57 games at AAA this year. So he's been hit by 28 pitches this year across the two levels. Ridiculous. Anyway, he survives that, and Joey Loperfido ends up coming up with RBI there as well. Spencer Horwitz stayed hot a little later. Ernie Clement had tripled. Spencer Horwitz doubled him home. So yeah, nice to see the Buffalo guys all contributing. And the Jays win 6-2, which if you're rooting for chaos in the National League wildcard picture, probably isn't the best outcome. The Braves, Dodgers, and Diamondbacks all won yesterday, so the Mets lost like 15% of playoff odds, and they're back into a tie for the final spot. Right now, they don't have the tiebreaker against the Braves, but those teams have three games left against each other in the final week of the season. I have a feeling those three games in the final week of the season will be what determines the outcome of this wildcard race, not how those two teams did against the Toronto Blue Jays over the 6 days here. Oh, by the way, the other thing that was happening last night in addition to the game, there was some minor league stuff that we'll update you on yesterday. Bo Bichette went 1-for-3 with an error in five innings playing shortstop. Jake Bloss got roughed up again in his AAA start. We'll go into that in more detail a little later, and we'll set you up for today's 3 o'clock game. It was also the Jays Care Foundation broadcast auction last night, which is always a great event, raises a lot of money for Jays Care Foundation, which does a lot of good work in communities around the country, especially with respect to baseball activities and bringing greater access to baseball and things like that. Among the things you could win were a fishing trip with Buck Martinez, golfing with Jose Bautista, and a New York trip, or just joining in the booth, our next guest, Dan Shulman, the voice of the Toronto Blue Jays on Sportsnet. He joins us now. Dan, how are we doing?
We're doing great, Blake. How are you?
I'm good. Do you know yet who won the Dan Shulman prizes? No.
No, I have no information at all. So I don't know. I guess I'll find that out at some point, but it's going to be fun. It's flights, hotel, and tickets and jerseys and caps. Two games, Friday and Saturday, when the Blue Jays play the Yankees in April, and then a dinner on Thursday night. And Buck said he would be on the trip, so I asked him to be my date. So it looks like it'll be a dinner with me and Buck. So, you know, very happy to be a small part of this and very grateful for all of the prizes that were bid on. I mean, I don't know what the final tally was. I didn't hear last night, but it was really great to see everybody bidding on all those prizes like that.
Yeah, I didn't get a final tally either, but the individual numbers were getting up there pretty high. So I'd imagine they did a pretty good dent for Jays Care Foundation. How upset would you have been if you came on and I was like, Dan, I won the New York prize?
Oh, I could think of worse. Yeah. I won't name them on the air, but you wouldn't be in my top five. So we've done that before, just us for free, and it's fun. Yeah. So yeah, we'd have had a good time. But I'm assuming they are tremendously nice people. And Buck and I will have to up our stories a little bit, because I know it went for an excess of $15,000. And granted, it's flights and hotels and transfers and tickets and all that as well. But we're gonna have to come up with some of our best stories to make sure we're worth it.
Yeah, I mean, Buck's gonna have that whole fishing trip to entertain some people as well. So Buck doing a lot of work here. It's great of you guys to do this stuff. Ben Shulman, of course, as well. Someone would have won being able to go on the the radio booth with him. So it's obviously a great thing Jay's Care Foundation is doing, and then a great thing people like you and Buck and Ben and everyone else involved are doing, offering up your time as well. Okay, so the game yesterday, in addition to all this stuff going on, pretty fun one for the Buffalo guys. I want to start with Davis Schneider because things had been, I mean, they still are. One hit doesn't necessarily break you out of it, but felt like that was a moment that Davis Schneider probably needed. Is that the sense you got having talked to him over the last couple of weeks as well?
Needed is an accurate word. I mean, it's been rough. It's been a long slump for him. And he's out there early every day. I get there between like 2:45 and 3 every day. And he's in that group of three or four guys every day taking early hitting. And, you know, you're there a lot. You know how people feel about him in that clubhouse, how popular he is. And I mean, his teammates, his buddies, his roommates, they've been just dying for him to break out of this. So not only to get an extra base hit, but to drive in a couple of runs too, I think meant a lot. And you're right, it's only one hit. You know, now you got to go out and do it again today. And I assume he'll be in the lineup today because there's a lefty on the mound for the Mets in Sean Manaea. But it's good to see. You were in John Schneider's office before the game when John Schneider was asked about the messaging for Davis Schneider. And he said 95% positive reinforcement. He said it's 5% like, hey, we got to get it going, but it's 95% positive reinforcement. And I think because they've seen him do it before, and because everybody in this organization, not just this team, like up and down through the minors as well, you know, he's been the guy who exceeded expectations. You know, how did he get here? How did he get here? That sort of thing. There are so many people who care so much for Davis Schneider. I think there were a lot of people who were very happy to see that hit. Hopefully he can continue to build on it. Only 3 weeks left in the season, less than that. And he's got to keep coming up with some big hits, obviously, as he hopes to solidify a spot for next year.
Yeah. And look, he's a guy that, you know, as good as this season was last year, I'm sure he's keenly aware that, you know, had this season gone differently for the team and he was playing this way, he'd be in Buffalo right now. Yeah. Like, I don't think it would be out of pocket for him to say that to him, or for him to admit that. You know, there were some great quotes that Chris Bassett gave Hazel May after the game last night about, you know, when you fail at this game, you find out who a person is. And Bassett was saying, to your point, Chris Bassett's there early and hasn't beaten Davis Schneider to the ballpark yet. So yeah, I'm with you. I think that was fun. Hopefully this can build. And he was obviously, I don't know if you were still there for the post game on field interview, but he seemed so appreciative of, you know, the crowd response and getting it, being able to have that moment as well. Potential for, you know, in a season that hasn't had a lot of positives, let's end on some positives here. Let's have a good couple of Davis Schneider weeks, right?
No question about it. I did see most of the interview. I missed one of the questions, I think, but he was completely sincere, obviously, in how he felt. And you're right. He knows, had any one of a number of other circumstances been different, he could have been in Buffalo and maybe not to resurface this year. But I think there's belief in him and affection for him all the way through the organization and a lot of people pulling for him. And they, you know, to John Schneider's credit, he keeps putting him in there against lefties. He's not in there much against righties, maybe once in the last few weeks, I think, but he's giving him some chances. And, you know, I get, I don't show it publicly much, but I'm a total, you know, sappy, sentimental kind of guy. And I like rooting for good guys, and he's a good guy. And I thought it was fun when Clement was at third, Horowitz was at first, and Schneider was at the plate last night. Like, everybody knows now, you know, you saw the picture they tweeted out with the CN Tower in the background yesterday. Everybody knows their three best friends and roommates and all of that. And in a season that has been not as fun as a lot of people hoped it would be, it's okay to find fun in, you know, little corners here and there. And those three guys are fun. And, you know, Ernie Clements had a really good season. I think he has elevated his stature within the organization. That's, you know, I don't know how you would argue that point. Obviously, Spencer Horowitz has done that too. So hopefully Davis Schneider can finish strong because there's a lot of good vibes with those three guys. It'd be nice to keep the gang together.
Yeah, Ernie Clement has played his way, especially defensively. Like the batting line is league average at this point after a couple of hits. Yes, give or take. Like obviously the on base isn't quite there, but he's added a little bit of pop, good contact skills. And then the defensive metrics love him, especially at third base. I know that he came up with that kind of a reputation. Does that line up with your eye test that he's been among the best maybe half dozen third basemen in baseball this year when he's been on the field?
I think so. I mean, he had one last night he would want back where he had a bobble, and instead of maybe starting a double play, they were only able to get the out at first. But by and large, he's been great. It's funny, before this year, I thought of him more as a shortstop second baseman, mm-hmm. not as much of a shortstop third baseman, but the opportunity for him was at third. And even before the opportunity was there, when he was in there against lefties, they would move Isaiah Kiner-Falefa to second and leave Clement at third. And that actually surprised me at the beginning. And obviously, I'm not privy to all of the, you know, the internal numbers that they have within the team. But I thought it would be the other way around, that Ernie would be at second and IKF would be at third. But they obviously saw something either with the eye test or with the metrics that said, hey, that's the guy that we want at third. And he's been great. He's going to wind up with about 100 starts this year, assuming, you know, things keep going the way that they're going. And I think somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe 75 of them will be at third base. I don't know if that's enough to win the Gold Glove at third base. He does lead all American League third baseman in defensive runs saved. And as you know, defensive metrics are a component of the Gold Glove Awards now. It's part coaches and manager voting and part metrics. So, you know, hopefully that helps him. And if it's not third base, he should be considered for the Utility Gold Glove, which is a new award not everybody may be familiar with. I think it's the fourth year now where there, you know, Mauricio Dubon won it last year for Houston. You know, and Ernie's played third and short. He's played second just a couple of times. But I would hope he would be considered for one of the two. And if you get a league average bat and superior defense and great vibes at an affordable rate, that's an asset. And Ernie Clement's been an asset this year.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I tried to bring up the Fangraphs leaderboards there to see where he'd rank among the qualified, but Fangraphs is down right now. So that's we'll have to – I mean, look, if he ends
well, I can
up
tell you this because I looked yesterday. He was seventh or eighth in the majors in defensive run save. All players, all positions, both leagues. And I know he was first among third basemen. And I know he was first among guys you would think of as utility players. So, but again, there is an element of coaches and manager voting. And is he as big of a name as Alex Bregman or Jose Ramirez? No, right? Does he have as many starts this year at any or all positions as Jose Ramirez or Alex Bregman? No. So it's a bit of an uphill climb, but hopefully he'll get considered.
Yeah, and like you said, the move to third base there, and I think you and I even talked about the IKF at second, Clement at third. The reason it seems a little odd is like, well, the knock on Ernie is the arm, and like the metrics still grayed out that, you know, hey, he's a below average arm for a third baseman, but he gets rid of it so fast that I think that makes it, like, I think he's talked to you before about, you know, why he has the release he does and whips it out of there quick, because, you know, he doesn't have the arm strength, right? So that that helps make up for it too. It's going to be interesting to really dive in on this Gold Glove stuff, because obviously Dalton Varsho is deserving of like the Platinum Glove. Alejandro Kirk is up to third in all of baseball in defensive value as well. I think Patrick Bailey is the only catcher who's ahead of him in that regard as well. So it's going to be, for a team that hasn't done very well overall, it's going to be a pretty fascinating Gold Glove season for this group.
Yeah, and they won the Team Gold Glove last year, which is another relatively new thing, and it doesn't get, you know, doesn't get a whole lot of attention. But the Varsho one is interesting again. And it's a little bit different than last year, because I don't know what the breakdown between left and center for him was last year. It was probably maybe 60% left, 40% center, maybe something like that. But this year with the trade of Kiermaier, it's probably going to wind up being more like 70-30 center field by the end of the season. But Jarren Duran is out there making plays and putting up great numbers in center field as well. And to win the play, and Dalton Varsho leads all major leaguers in defensive runs saved, and it's actually not even very close. But it's split over two positions. And to win the Platinum Glove, unless I'm mistaken, to win the Platinum Glove, you have to have been a Gold Glove winner. And so here's a guy who could be deserving of a Platinum Glove who still isn't a lock to win a Gold Glove. In the old days, and the old days aren't that long ago, but you could just pick any three outfielders. It didn't have to be left, center, right. It was just any three outfielders. And then Varsho's a shoo-in, right? So, but it might be tooth and nail with Jarren Duran again to win the Gold Glove in center field this year. I hope he gets it. He deserved a Gold Glove last year. He deserves one this year. I wonder if it makes sense just in the outfield to go back to pick any three guys, because players do move around so much more than they used to. And for even Jarren Duran was doing it. He was playing a lot of left field earlier in the year. So, I mean, I hope both Varsho and Clement are seriously considered. And as you said, Alejandro Kirk's numbers are very good. No matter what you want to look at, blocking, framing, throwing, above average caught stealing percentage, his arm strength has improved over the years. So I could see, I don't know if he wins it. I think Cal Raleigh's going to get a lot of consideration as well. His numbers are good too. But, and again, he's a bigger name probably than Alejandro Kirk. So all of these guys face some obstacles, but hopefully they'll all be considered.
Yeah, it'll be fun to track. And with respect to Varsho, I can't remember. I looked this up this morning, and he is 7th and 14th in the league in defensive runs saved if you break it up by center field and left field. So hopefully reason prevails here when it gets down to the voting and things like that. Okay, last one on the to round it out on the Buffalo guy. Spencer Horwitz was also a part of that. Another double yesterday. He obviously had an incredible weekend. Has he changed your opinion of what he can be as a bat this year at all with the amount of power he's been able to show? Obviously not, you know, he's not going to hit 40 home runs here, but the right. home runs have been a little more than advertised in addition to the doubles power we knew was coming.
I think so. I think before I really got to know him and to see him play on a regular basis, you know, just looking at the numbers and hearing the narrative, I kind of thought maybe he was an 8 to 12 home run guy. You knew he was going to take his walks. You knew he was going to hit doubles. You knew he would hit for a good average. But he's got, is it 12 home runs? I think it's 12 home runs now in, I don't even know if he's gotten to 300 at-bats yet. So, you know, it's not, and they've shielded him a little bit from some of the tough lefties, right? If you just put him in there every day, the numbers aren't going to keep going up probably at the same rate, because he'd be in there against tough lefties, which is going to be a tougher matchup, although the double he hit last night was off a lefty. But yes, he has. I mean, it's not outlandish at all to say, well, maybe he's a 20 home run guy. Like, he's got 12 and fewer than 300 at-bats. So here's the one thing I hope. It looks like they are moving away from him at second base, which puts him back into the first base DH pot. I think he's good enough to do that. If you can hit 20 homers and 30 doubles and walk 70 times and hit whatever, 270, 280. So if you're like a 270, 280 hitter with a 360 on base and a 450 slug, you know, if you're an 800 OPS guy, that's pretty good. And I know I've said this a lot, but making very little money by modern baseball standards, that is an asset. I would like Spencer Horwitz and Ernie Clement and all of these guys to make as much money as they can make. But right now, Spencer Horwitz is not arbitration eligible. I don't even think he isn't even after next year, I don't believe. No, he wouldn't even be after next year. He would be an asset to this team. And I just really hope that old, well, I don't know if he's got enough pop for first base TH. I don't buy that. He's a good player. He's a good hitter. You can hit him first or second or fifth or wherever you want to hit him, and he's going to help. And I hope he is on this team next year. And I don't think he's going to be at Buffalo. I mean, I hope he's in this organization and on this team next year, because I'm certain there would be a lot of teams who would be interested in trading for him. But and there are too many guys here now for all of them to be here next year, which is another conversation we can have at some point. But yes, I certainly think he has shown more than a lot of people felt he had, and that's a credit to him and all the work that he's put in with all of the various hitting coaches. And I think he can be a valuable asset for this team. And I just really hope that there aren't people still saying, yeah, but first base DH, there's not enough pop there. So there are other, I know they need more power, but, you know, third base, left field, you know, there are places to find it. And I think Spencer Horwitz has done enough that he should be considered a must-have on this team next year.
Yeah, here's the thing about, first base and DH is a power spot. It's all about the way the rest of your roster is constructed. Right. Like, you know, if you are, you know, are the Yankees getting a ton of power out of Anthony Rizzo right now? I know he just got back healthy, but, like, who cares? You have Aaron Judge and Juan Soto in the outfield. Like, if you're getting 80 homers from your center field and right field spots, you don't really need it as much from first base. And on base is really important, right? Like you look at Vlad's season, and it's been really good. He's hit an awful lot with nobody on base. So, you know, whether that's, you know, hey, you have to, people will have to look at this in the front office. We'll have to look at this as, what is the best nine? What is the best 13? Not what is the best first baseman? What is the best left fielder? What is the best third base? Like, we're past that. I think agree. I'm with you. And I think, you know, yeah. I think I'm less a little less than most willing to see Spencer Horwitz against lefties, given where the numbers were in the minor leagues and in a small sample here, but absolutely should have a role on the team next year. You know, if there's Vlad at first and you get a right-handed DH and he's a lefty who comes in once in a while, there are a lot of ways to use a good left-handed bat like that. Dan, last one for you on the Blue Jays. Bowden Francis tonight, I mean, we've all talked about it a ton, but what are you looking for over these last couple starts of just kind of keeping it rolling here?
I'm not looking for, you know, no hit bids into the ninth or anything like that. That's unrealistic. What he did in August was incredible and fantastic and, you know, certainly got everybody's attention. But I think we need to be fair to Bowden Francis and you know, nobody sustains what he did over four or five starts in a row in August. You know what I thought? I thought his last start, which was against the Phillies, if I'm not mistaken, and he gave up three runs in the first two innings and then went four shutout innings after that. I think that's really good against that team that he did that. I would love to see him just go out there and give six good innings his last three, four times out this year just to continue to get the reps, build up the experience, you know, continue to sharpen his command, his pitch sequencing, his game planning, all of those things. As Chris Bassitt said, yeah, he's 28, but he's relatively inexperienced in the major leagues, and that's true. I just think just keep going out there, eat up innings, and put up solid outings. Just be a good, solid part of this starting rotation is a great step forward every 5 or 6 days for him the rest of the year and for him to solidify, hey, he's one of our guys, for the team to say he's one of the guys going into 2025 in the rotation. I don't know how you win pitcher of the month and you don't at least, you know, start banging down the door for, hey, pencil me into the rotation next year. But, you know, let's not make it too unrealistic on him. Let's not hype him too much, but just keep going out there. And if you can give him six quality innings every time out, I think that's great.
Yeah. And look, he's given them six or more in five consecutive starts, which has been pretty rare for this team this year. I mean, it's pretty rare around baseball, given that's a whole other conversation. But yeah, it'll be fun to see how he can, you know, continue to keep this role, maybe make it six, seven starts of six innings or more in a row. Okay, before I let you go, there is a Green Bay Packers helmet behind you. How are you feeling? I didn't dare ask Dalton Varsho about it this week, although I really wanted to pick his brain on how the team's fantasy league went week one. I know he had Christian McCaffrey, so that'd be risky. I didn't want to dare ask him about the Packers, though. I will ask you about the Packers. Malik Willis gonna start this week, picked up off the scrap heap at the end of training camp. How you feeling?
Varsho's the commissioner too of the team, team, so I think you could ask him a general question and see if he kind of, you know, leads you to the Packers. So obviously, super hyped team coming in after the way they finished last year and the young core and Jordan Love, et cetera, et cetera. And I was a little nervous that the hype was a little bit too big, and I always thought there was a chance they could lose the first game. I was emotionally totally ready for them to lose the first game. I didn't watch the game because I was doing the Blue Jay game. I kind of had like a game cast on, and it was back and forth, but it was sloppy the whole game. It didn't feel like a game where they were playing well. So fine, there's 30 seconds left in the game. You start 0-1, no big deal. And I'm back in my hotel at this point, and I'm watching it on my laptop, and then you see the injury. And it's like, you got to be kidding me, because there's no sport of the, you know, the four big team sports, there's no sport where losing one specific player can crush your season as much as an NFL team losing its great young quarterback. So in that moment, thought it could be season ending. And the longer it went without them saying anything, the worse I thought it was going to be. Then you hear what it is. That's an MCL. And that kind of sounds like 4 to 6 weeks. And now all of a sudden it's like they're not going to put them on IR and blah, blah, blah. So right now where I'm at is not knowing when he'll come back. Like, can they just be like 2-3 after 5 weeks and not have buried themselves when he comes back? Because, you know, he's still relatively inexperienced. He needs reps, right? As great as he was at the end of last year, he still needs to get out there. I just hope he gets back in time where they're not buried, and that they've got a chance to make the playoffs. I don't care if it's 10-7 or 13-4, whatever, just got a chance to make the playoffs. So emotionally, we're all kind of week to week right now in Titletown.
Well, I will hope for good things, because half of the people around the Blue Jays are somehow Packers fans. So, you know, I want all you guys to be happy as well. So hopefully, and look, I'm an AFC South guy, so I wouldn't mind the Colts losing this week. That'd be fine, sure. Given the poor start the Jaguars are off to here as well. No injury excuses for them. Just downright poor play calling. Dan Schulman, thanks for taking the time out, man. Really appreciate it.
All right, Blake. Thanks. Anytime.
Dan Schulman, voice of the Toronto Blue Jays on Sportsnet. Yeah, congrats to whoever won those packages that involved Dan Schulman and Buck Martinez and Jose Bautista and Pat Borders and everyone else who won in the Jays Care Foundation broadcast auction last night. A lot of fun down at the park. Hearing about some of that. Yeah, fun night down at the park generally, and just a beautiful, beautiful day for it. Okay, let's take a break. There's no windows in here. I assume it's nice out. It was nice out on my way in. 3 o'clock game. It's a work from dome game for Bowden Francis against Sean Manaea. We'll tee that one up. We'll give you a couple of the updates from the minor leagues that I mentioned a little earlier. We've also got just a loaded show today. We're going to talk to Ben Clemens after the break, Kylie McDaniel. We'll talk to Disha Thosar as well. And again, get you set up for that 3 o'clock start. Ben Clemens is next as Jays Talk Plus rolls on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360. Introducing Seeker, Canada's new app for discovering or rediscovering music. Dive into captivating podcasts, stay up to date with the latest news, debate last night's game, and laugh along with your favorite DJs. It's all there in one easy-to-use free app. Simply download Seeker, that's S-E-E-K-R, from the App Store or Google Play. Find the radio, podcasts, news, and sports you love.
Seeker.
Seeker. Seek your sounds. Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. We'll talk to Ben Clemens of Fangraphs in a couple minutes here. Saw a ridiculous stat during the break. There was a presidential debate last night. There was another presidential debate a couple months ago. In between those two debates, the Chicago White Sox went 10-52. Remarkable stuff. A couple updates for you before we talk to Ben Clemens. I mentioned off the top, Bo Bichette did get into his first rehab game for AAA Buffalo yesterday. He played shortstop. His first plate appearance, a ground out to Kevin Biggio, who is, yes, playing down in AAA in the Giants organization. He also grounded into a double play that Kevin Biggio started. Bichette also had a throwing error that helped lead to a six-run inning for Jake Bloss. Now, Bloss was responsible for a lot of it. He walked a guy, he hit a guy, he grooved a fastball for a grand slam, but not the best of starts. Bo did also have a single. So 1-for-3, played 5 innings in the field, made a throwing error. He's going to be down there probably for the entire week, get into 3 or 4 or 5 games. Probably DH one or two of them, play shortstop in some of them. We'll see how that continues to go. Aurelvis Martinez is also back. This was his second game back. He went 2-for-4. So two hit games in a row. He had a double and a triple yesterday. Final line on Jake Bloss, 3 innings, 8 runs, 7 of them earned. So Jake Bloss maybe not imminently getting called up. That's 2 rough ones in his last 3 outings for him at the AAA level. Elsewhere in the farm system, Adam Macko will start tonight for AA New Hampshire. This will be his last start of the season because they wrap up on Sunday. But it's nice that he is back because obviously he had been injured, made a couple rehab starts with Single-A Dunedin. Who knows? Maybe they bump him to Buffalo for one final start or something like that, but he'll be back. And then Vancouver Canadiens are in the championship for the High A Northwest League. Unfortunately, they lost game one last night, 4-3. Jay Harry, who the Jays picked up at the trade deadline, did homer in that one. Ryan Watson had an okay start, but just couldn't quite do it. They'll play game 2 down at the Nat in Vancouver tonight. So if you are a Vancouver area listener, make sure you get down there. Playoff ball at Nat Bailey Stadium. I've not been there. I was going to say it's awesome. I assume it's awesome. I've been there for regular season ball a bunch, but never for a playoff game. Lock in game 2 tonight. Let's talk Major League Baseball. Again, let's talk to Ben Clemens of Fangraphs. Ben, good morning. How are we doing?
I'm doing well. How are you, Blake?
Good, man. How was Sabre Seminar? I've had people on the show who went to Sabre Seminar, and I keep forgetting to ask everyone how it was, other than reading Michael Rosen's wonderful piece at Defector.
Yeah, it was great. I got to meet Michael. That was really nice. He's been my coworker for a little bit now, but we often don't get to meet in person because we're just random internet guys and women, but honestly, mainly guys. It was really fun. I don't often get a chance to just like purely nerd out about baseball like that with, 150, 200 people there who really only wanted to be there to look at these baseball studies. And we're all excited about it. It was pretty fun. And I got a lot of ideas for use in the future and did a bunch of good networking. Also, Chicago has great food. So really across the board, pretty nice.
I do love Chicago. Yeah, it's the closest city to Toronto that I have experienced, which is, you know, it's nice to leave and then everything feels kind of familiar but new. So, yeah, Chicago, great city. Glad you guys had a great time. I love, you know, the amount of tweets that come out of it or things will pop up in articles the next couple of weeks and you'll be able to trace back to what got talked about at Sabre Seminar. I haven't gotten to go before, but I look at the website and like read everything that's going to get presented and stuff like that. It's a lot of fun. What is, if you don't mind giving it away, what's one of the like front of mind ideas that you came out of there? Like, oh, I should dig in deeper. I should write about this.
So a high school student, that's a lot of the people who do these presentations, was doing something about basically changes in count and whether foul balls can change the way that the count goes from there on out. And I didn't exactly take off directly from their study, but I'm interested in this, like whether getting to a 3-2 count like in different ways matters, whether getting to a 2-2 count in different ways matters. And so I'm starting to dig into that so we can say, hey, like this count isn't quite what you think it means because of X foul balls beforehand. I haven't found anything yet, but I think that's a really interesting concept and something that, you know, I've always been kind of dancing around and never quite had the right words to put to paper.
What do we call it? Markov chains? Is that how we trace that stuff?
Yeah. My note says Markov chains, not right? ? Investigate. Okay, so there you go.
Okay. Let's talk stuff that is happening more imminently. The Mets and Braves are locked in a wild card race here. It is tied. The Braves currently hold the tiebreaker, but they've got 3 games left against each other. Are you surprised at all at the staying power of the Braves at this race, given the amount of injuries and like key pieces that they've lost and the fact that like, oh yeah, let's get Jorge Soler and let's have him be a disaster in the outfield and hit like 180. You know, good on them for trying to keep, I'm a little surprised it's all held together with silly string so well.
Yeah, it's amazing. they're missing so many good players and that some of their good players are having bad seasons. And I just can't believe that they're continuing to do it. It doesn't look fake either. Like you look at their statistics and you know, like they don't have this record on accident. Like even these much worse players are playing quite well, but God, the amount of players they've lost to injury is just unbelievable. I almost feel like Alex Anthopoulos is doing one of the best jobs he's ever done. And it's like not one of the better Braves teams, but the degree of difficulty is just so high. I mean, you lose your 2 best players, you're normally not thinking that hard about the playoffs that year, and they've lost more than that. It's pretty crazy. This race is great. I love that it's Mets and Braves. I love particularly that it's the Mets, not last year when they had Verlander and Scherzer, but this year, you know, after allegedly Steve Cohen told Scherzer that they weren't going to try to make the playoffs this year. It's got a got a lot going for it, and Mets fans really dislike the Braves, but it's kind of low stakes. Like this is for the last wild card spot, and I think it just lines up really well for a fun last month of baseball there.
It is low stakes, but I do wonder if, like, that final, the second to last series of the season, the Mets are in Atlanta, I do wonder if the Mets fans have been baited into a heartbreak. I mean, like, I think about, like, I don't know, you're big blind on a hand and you're in with a hand that you shouldn't have. And then the flop comes, but then you're on like a straight chase or something like that. And right, then you're in more like you didn't have any business investing in the first place, but then you got the good fortune and then you invested from there. Yeah. And then you're like, oh no, now I'm pot committed.
There was a seven. I couldn't stop. Yeah.
Anyway, I shouldn't get too far down the poker analogy for anyone who doesn't know poker, but yeah, I feel like maybe they're getting baited into a little bit of heartbreak here. So the Fangraphs odds as of this morning have the Braves at 69%, the Mets at 46%. That's not, you know, there's greater than 50-50 there because the Diamondbacks and Padres still haven't locked up their space, although they do have a 2 and 2.5 game gap. Respectively. Does that feel right to you in terms of like the chance at like 50-50-ish for the Mets?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that at this point in the season, team quality doesn't matter that much. having a record that is close to the record required to make playoffs is basically, it's a huge determiner. When I looked into how much it all matters, having the vastly, wildly superior Braves pitching staff, as opposed to the, acceptable, band of misfits chugging right along Mets pitching staff, was worth a win over the last month. And there's less time left than that now, and they're still tied. And that's a big difference. Like, the difference between the Braves pitching staff, maybe the best in baseball this year, and the Mets pitching staff average, is only worth a win over a month? Well, okay, then it's basically a toss-up. And that's kind of what it's come out. That's how it looks to me now. I think the fact that the series is in Atlanta and that the Braves will probably be able to line up some pitchers for it certainly hurts the Mets. I think if it weren't for that, I'd feel even better about their chances. But hey, they did the hard work of a team that honestly had some holes. That's kind of the Mets thing. They definitely weren't all in for this year. I'm pretty impressed that they've made it this far. Good job, Francisco Lindor.
Yeah, great job for Francisco Lindor. It's been awesome. Elsewhere in that race, the Diamondbacks have had some injuries as well. They obviously don't have the run prevention that some of these other teams have, but they have the best offense in baseball by run scored. The Padres seem to me, and you can correct me if you feel differently, the safest, I guess, of these four teams in terms of which team is actually good. I know you wrote about Michael King recently too, who, I think kind of quietly has a 3.10 ERA over 160 innings, the key piece in the Juan Soto trade. Yeah. Where are you at on where the Padres are? And I guess to some extent, Michael King's role in that and a wild card series, not unexpectedly, but maybe not entirely expectedly.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think they're the team that I look at and I'm like, oh yeah, that team's good. I mean, the Braves, but they're hurt. So the current iteration, I look at the Padres and the most, I'm like, yeah, that's a good team. I think that Michael King being good before the season, I wouldn't have thought he was quite this good. And then he had just a terrible first month. But the reason that the Padres got him was always still there, which is that he was awesome last year on the Yankees when he had that kind of last half of this, maybe last third of the season stint as a starter. And if anything, he's figured out how that playbook works a little bit better. It is funny that I'm not actually sure who the Padres ace is. Maybe it's him. I like Dylan Cease a little bit more.
Yeah.
But the fact that they have these two guys who you're not quite sure who their ace is, neither of whom were on the team last year when they won the Cy Young and had other good pitchers, including one who will probably finish in the top three in the Cy Young in the AL this year, Seth Lugo. It's pretty impressive. Like it is fun to make fun of the Padres because AJ Preller is just, I don't know, probably right now he's chugging Diet Coke or I don't know, something stronger and trying to make trades. And all the GMs are like, there's no trades right now, AJ. It's all shut down for a month. He's just he's going a mile a minute all the time, but it's kind of working. It's kind of working, at least in terms of he understands that if he sees some player he wants to go out and get and is willing to keep the pieces moving, he can do it. I think that a lot of teams who lost what the Padres lost last year and needed to, cut on salary by getting rid of Juan Soto wouldn't come out of it this well. I think that the commitment of trying to make the playoffs is definitely something you can appreciate. As a Blue Jays fan and as a Cardinals fan, for me, sometimes it feels to have some urgency.
Yes, have some urgency. Yeah, show make it feel like you want to win as badly as the fans want to win. Obviously, the Jays and Cardinals were not in a spot to do this at this year's trade deadline, but go out and get three closers for your bullpen. So your bullpen's really good for the playoff. They don't cost that much. Look at the Yankees and Orioles right now. Both of their bullpens have been below average since the trade deadline, well below average by ERA, and neither of them can run with the division. It's if they had gone AJ Preller mode, instead of just in the Orioles case, hey, what if we get the Phillies cast-offs? Maybe this looks a little different with a Tanner Scott, a Jason Adam, a Brian Hoeing or something like that.
Yeah, doing that and doing it just over and over again. Go out and trade for a starting pitcher in the offseason if you think you need one. I think, that's really admirable, but also it means that the Padres are the most solid-looking team of these. And Fernando Tatis being back and them doing pretty well in the race when he wasn't is also pretty impressive for them, but look, they have a lot of good players, and if you're willing to treat your team a little bit like fantasy baseball and say, hey, like Dylan Cease was good last year. Here's some prospects. Give me Dylan Cease. Hey, like Michael King was, well, Michael King's a bad example because they gave up one soda. No one likes to do that. But like they are just good about, yeah, like go, like you said, get three closers if you think you might need them. Get a starter if you think you might need them. More teams should do that. And I think it's cool that the Padres are succeeding after doing that.
Yeah. Also, they did the, if we only acquire shortstops, I'm going to trust that a shortstop can play somewhere else if we have too many shortstops. Pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty good bet there. Okay. Elsewhere in that NL West, the Dodgers are also pretty good. Shohei is now at 46 home runs and 47 stolen bases. You, as you did with the Aaron Judge home run chase, you have modeled out, you know, when he might do this and if he might do this. Before he got that 47 stolen base, you had it at a 61.3% chance that he does it, with the likeliest timing coming, obviously, later in the season. How are you feeling about it now? Two games, one stolen base later, 61% feel. It felt a little light to me. Like, I feel more confident than that he's going to get the 50-50.
Yeah, I actually reran it at the beginning of this call with the last two games and the stolen base, and it's 62% now, which I'm with you. It feels a little light to me. It was 68% yesterday before he went the game with no steals. It's actually pretty easy to update, so I just do it every morning.
Nice.
I think I mentioned this at some point in writing it, but steals are kind of tricky because if he really wants them, like he can just take off every time, right? And he's fast, so I think he's at least 50-50 to get it. I've been modeling his steals like he's stealing the way he has all year, which is very well. I think he's one of the best base stealers in baseball. And with a sense of when he should take off. If he ignored that and just started going every time, I think that would mess with the odds a little bit. I think that the main reason this all sounds lower than you'd expect is that joint probabilities are just kind of sneaky hard.
Yeah.
If you do like just the odds of him getting 50 home runs or getting 50 steals, they're much higher. I still think it's low. And I still think that he's going to find a way to get the steals. And so it's just a question of the homers. Four homers in how many games is it at this point? One. Actually, I can just count here. In 17 games. That's like, I mean, you know, it's not a given, but I think pretty likely. And series-wise, I think the fact that he's not going fast at all just keeps it in the last two series. It looks like the most likely individual game is still in the last series of the season, and now the two most likely games are in the last series of the season. So I would expect Denver to be overrun with tourists. I know that that this chase is dominating baseball headlines and sports headlines in general in Japan and has been for a while. I expect the tourism to be out in force because it would be pretty cool to see this. I was kind of hoping I could, well, they're not playing the Giants here in any of these games, unfortunately, so there's just no way I can swing going to it, but I was really hoping I get to see it.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Like, I remember when you were doing this for the Aaron Judge chase, I've said this on air before, instead of going as media, I sat in left field for the three games of Jays Yankees, and he hit the tying home run, but not the winning one. And the Shohei chase is so extreme that New York baseball fans have somehow convinced themselves that there is an anti-New York sports media bias, which is, my brain is exploding. Okay, let's talk New York baseball, though. The Yankees finally called up Jason Dominguez. This is, I know you've, in your chats and things like that, been mostly like, calm down, Yankees and Orioles fans. Like, both of these teams are good. It's just the way a season goes. The addition of Jason Dominguez and more like tactically, the Yankees having that element of speed now with him and Anthony Volpe in the lineup. How much do you like that for them? Maybe not for the East race because it's going to come down to a coin flip, but just generally the way they're constructed now that they have that speed and youth element with Dominguez and Volpe together.
Yeah. I think it's really addition by subtraction in that Alex Verdugo was not it for them as a solution. I think Dominguez does what they were kind of hoping Verdugo would do. I mean, you know, he can play defense. He is a competent hitter, but yeah, with like more speed and more explosion. I think that, I don't know if they're exactly gonna like pair them in the lineup. I kind of have liked having Volpe down towards the bottom of the lineup where he's not supposed to be like this on-base slappy hitty guy, which doesn't really seem like it worked for him all that well. I think the real key with Dominguez is just that, yeah, it's another source of upside in this lineup that isn't at the top. The top is so stable that I feel like you can kind of like place a few bets on upside, and when they don't work out, just try some more. I like doing it with Dominguez. I don't know that he's going to completely change the complexion of the lineup, but they are starting from such a good place that all you really have to do to make this just the best, probably the best lineup in baseball, I like them over the Diamondbacks for run scoring despite the numbers, is just not have embarrassing holes in the lineup. And I felt like at times that was what Verdugo was. I think he's better than that in the long run, but I don't think you want to try to figure out if he can pull out of it kind of like in real time in a tight playoff race. So I like the move. I'm a little surprised they didn't do it earlier, not because I think it's going to be hugely different like in terms of projections, but just because like do something, like find things out. Don't care about median projections, like play for volatility a little bit when you're shuffling the end of your bench. I would have done it earlier. I like Dominguez though, so maybe I'm just biased.
No, I think it makes sense in a lot of different ways. And yeah, the reasons they weren't calling him up didn't really hold water when you investigated them. Okay, Ben, before I let you go here, we'll have to talk about the RE24 war stuff another time because we're running tight on time. But yeah. I know every year you do your top 50 MLB free agents at FanGraphs and some contract projections and things like that. When you do that exercise, how much are you factoring in like, oh, say Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette are free agents in 2026, but possibly, you know, they could get an extension. Like, is there like a rolling factor of, well, this free agent class is stronger than the next two free agent classes project to be, so maybe teams will spend a little bit more willingly this year? How does kind of a multi-year layer play into these things?
So I haven't, and I should have. And so I'm actually working on how to do that this year. And I think basically what you said is right. The example I use that has made me think about this is you look at what the Giants did in the past few off seasons. They tried to get Aaron Judge and they didn't. And so they did nothing that year, basically. They kind of mulliganed. And then they took that money and tried to get Shohei Ohtani. And so you can kind of see that they had this plan. Like, we've got this cash and there's this guy in 1 year and this guy in the next year. And then when that didn't work and they looked at this year and saw that there was no one, they just went and signed a bunch of people, you know, Soler, Matt Chapman, Blake Snell. And so you can see that teams are looking over time and saying like, well, this year it's okay if we miss because there's a good replacement next year. Like, we'd prefer to hit, but we've got a backup plan. And then when you don't, like, because this year's free agent class is not good. It's the weakest in a while. And you could tell the Giants, when they didn't hit last year, were like, okay, but we know next year is bad. So our backup plan is more this year. I think that kind of thinking absolutely matters. I would prefer next year's class. Like, there's lots of uncertainty. Like you said, these guys might sign extensions, like they might decline. I think extensions are more likely. I think that the presence of Vlad specifically is going to make hittery first guys just, their market's not going to be as good this year if it's questionable. So like Pete Alonso, I cannot imagine a team like tripping over themselves and kind of paying the iron price, as it were, like going way over the top to get Pete Alonso when they're like, I have questions about him because he's had two straight kind of like not what you'd hope seasons. It's not like he's bad, but he's declined from like perennial all-star to like good player. And hey, like, it's going to be embarrassing if I get him and then he's not that good and I actually wanted Vlad. I wouldn't go too far in that kind of thinking for any one player, but I think the fact that there's no like obvious break the bank guys this year and there are some interesting players next year kind of changes the equation to where I can imagine that you wouldn't be absolutely devastated if you couldn't allocate your money this year. Like, Kyle Tucker's available next year potentially. That's a nice I think actually his injury makes that interesting, makes it a little bit less likely that the Astros are going to sign him to a big extension right now, just because I haven't seen a lot of those when the players are hurt and just returning. And that puts him into his free agency year. He's a nice prize. I still think Bo is really good, even though, you know, he's not showing it hasn't showed it in a little bit. And is he gonna like play out the last few weeks on the major league team? Is he basically done rehabbing?
He started a rehab assignment last night, so we expect him back, if not this weekend against St. Louis, then in Texas next week. So the idea just being like, hey, let's get some reps under you. Let's make it so you know, March 27th, 2025 is not your first at bat in you know, 9 months.
I'll tell you this, if he has a 3-for-4 game next week, I'm going to be like, he's back. Like, I am just so easy to convince.
Yeah, I mean, look, he's a very good player. And he's started to do the PR game now where he's saying, like, hey, I want to be in Toronto. I want to win with Vladdy long-term. So, yeah, it'll be, look, it would be a nice thing to happen at the end of a bad season here. Ben, got to let you go, man. Thanks so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Ben Clemens of FanGraphs. Keep an eye out for those free agent projections, which will come out at some point between now and the end of the season as well. Also, just a ton of great work from Ben and everyone else at FanGraphs. Make sure you're checking in there daily. Let's take a break. Let's go to one of our other favorites over at ESPN, Kylie McDaniel. We'll talk a little bit more about that free agent class this year. He also ranked all 30 Major League Baseball cores, the players that you have and who's under control and things like that. Shocker, the Toronto Blue Jays. With their bottom 10 farm system, a couple guys 1 year from free agency, and having traded away a bunch of guys at the deadline, don't rank all that high. A lot of work to do this offseason. We'll talk to Kylie McDaniel about how they'll do it next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
The best Blue Jays show out there, period. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays win yesterday, so the New York Mets have fallen into a tie again for the final wildcard spot with the Braves. Braves won, Padres won, Diamondbacks won. All those teams in a better spot in the standings and maybe long-term than the Toronto Blue Jays. Let's talk to Kylie McDaniel of ESPN about how things look long-term. Kylie, good morning, man. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Always appreciate it. Want to go a lot of different directions with you today, but want to start with a bigger picture one. You've ranked all 30 Major League Baseball cores recently at ESPN. You know, hey, who do you have under control? What does the farm system look like? What does your Major League roster look like? How close are your key players to free agency? Not a surprise, given the conversations we've had this year, Kylie, that the Jays came in 24th, which is down from 14th last year, down from 5th 2 years ago. When you see that multi-year decline without playoff results to kind of, you know, justify any of it, I think is it fair to say that they have mostly squandered what looked in 2022 or 2021 even like a really favorable window there?
I would say that's a fair way to talk about it. I think next year, I think a lot of people thought this year would be a big important year for the direction of the franchise, and that by about midseason, oh, there might be some changes. This could be a pivot year. There's going to be the, you know, the Bichette and Guerrero decisions, whether it's trade or extension or play it out or, you know, whatever it might be. It seems like, I mean, I'm not reporting it, but the buzz is that there will not be a change at the top this year, that there's going to be sort of another year tacked on to what everyone thought was sort of a judgment year this year, to see how it's going to play out. And so that's what I expect it to be. I expect there to be either decisions or, I would say, indications toward a decision when it comes to Guerrero and Bichette and the bigger picture. I don't get the impression that there's like a ton more money to be spent. So you have to figure out how to make the team better. What's there? Obviously, whenever I come on, I'm always talking about the farm system, which is not fantastic, but you do have Aroldis Martinez and Ricky Tiedemann and, you know, some guys that are close, even if they're not necessarily going to be maybe opening day solutions. They're guys that like might play next year, or I guess in Tiedemann's case, the year after. I think this is going to be a really important year just because there's also going to be some very important decisions to be made about the two best players on the team. And also, can Bichette turn things around? Is Gausman going to bounce back? Is Barrios going to be the best version of himself? Is Bowden Francis for real? Like, there's like a list of guys where it's like, if they all hit at the same time and everyone gets extended and everyone's healthy and some guys come up, like, it's not hard to imagine this working, just because I feel like the last few years coming on here, it's been like, oh, are they going to make the playoffs this upcoming season? It's like, well, yeah, there's like a ton of ways you can imagine it happening. And this year, just everything kind of went wrong.
Yeah, it did. And, you know, that doesn't mean everything's going to go right next year, but it means it probably will go better than it went this year. You really hope anyway. When it comes to those Vlad and Bo conversations, have you started to work through that at all of like what that could look like? Or is that, you know, I know you do so much work projecting free agent contracts and looking at that. Is like pre-free agency extensions just too difficult a thing to predict? Or have you started working through, you know, what would make sense to you on those fronts?
Bo, I definitely have it because that doesn't really make a lot of sense after a down season. I don't think he'd want to lock in a number. I think it's really, is he going to have a good season? And if so, maybe 2 months in, the discussion can begin if both sides are open to doing it during the year. Otherwise, kind of letting it play out. Vlad, I also haven't looked at it necessarily. But it's an interesting one because I feel like a lot of the guys that get these mega extensions early on tend to not have the position inflexibility that Vlad has. I think you could maybe look at Devers as an example of a guy who's been, I think he's at roughly the same age, roughly the same level of production and service time. I think that's getting in the area. Although I'd shade it down a little bit just because it's been a little bit rockier and it's first base rather than third base. And I believe Devers was it like $310 million or something like that? So I would imagine it's going to be in the heavy twos, maybe with some options and things like that based on aging. That would be sort of like my general expectation. But he also has to want to sign that. And so them both being on the same page at the same time is going to be like a little harder. And for all we know, Vlad just really wants to test free agency. I don't think anyone's really talked about that. I don't get the impression that's the case, but sometimes in these situations, because I obviously have been involved in these situations before where it's like, oh, we're 2 years out. Let's give him both of those years and lock up 2 years of free agency. And sometimes the player's just like, no, I don't want to do that. Like, I want to see how much I'm worth. And you can't really bridge that gap if that's what they want to find out.
Yeah, you can't fault them, right? Like, you've earned the right to free agency. That's the way the whole system is set up. You're allowed to do that. Okay, so I want to circle back to the Jays and the work they have to do in a minute here when we talk about, you know, the free agency rankings you wrote up the other week. But I wanted to say when we're talking about ranking these MLB cores around baseball, the Rockies ranked dead last for a third consecutive year. Do we have to start thinking of, like, outside-the-box solutions to fix the Rockies or, like, save that fan base from what's going on there?
I feel like I say this a lot. When it comes to a really bad organization that's like bottom five, multiple departments, multiple years, usually 10 years, it is 95% of the time it's about the owner. If you look at the bottom three in cores this year, it's the Angels, the White Sox, and the Rockies. and then the A's and Marlins are also right there. And then it's like some teams that had, you know, bad seasons or a rebuilding or whatever, like the sort of normal versions of like down cycles. And it's just like the four worst owners and then the Marlins, who are basically might have a bottom five owner and are basically trying to reset the entire organization and just started doing it. So none of the really good players have like gotten to the big leagues yet. Right. So it's also just like that's how that kind of thing happens. And I mean, there have been stories since I started in baseball, it's almost 20 years of ridiculous stories about how the Rockies have been run. And they have a streak going like the Dallas Cowboys or the Pittsburgh Steelers, where it's like they've low-key had like three GMs in like 30 years and have had very little success, and they've all been doing the same thing. And it's like, hey, guess what's been consistent from the beginning to the end there? It's been a terrible owner. It's been in charge of everything.
Yeah, and look, Bud Black is, I believe, about to set a record for most consecutive seasons with a winning percentage below 460 without getting let go as well. So, yeah, we gotta look at the Montfort brothers and the I guess lack of eagerness to change anything or invest or, you know, have a single person looking at not even analytics, like something like on base percentage, like have one person in the organization watch Moneyball. That's the next step for the Rockies. Elsewhere, in terms of front office stability, I think probably like sticker wise, what I was most surprised at on first read of your rankings was the Mariners were in fourth. And I'm not surprised in the sense that they don't have a good farm system. Obviously they do, especially at the higher end. And they have, you know, good, young, affordable pitchers, Julio Rodriguez locked up. But there was some eyebrow raising about Jerry Dipoto reportedly getting an extension here with only one playoff appearance in the last 10 years. Obviously, he has that awkward 54% quote that he shouldn't have said publicly a couple years back. But when you look at something like Dipoto's job stability, even without the playoff success, the Mariners are in a pretty good spot here for the next couple years, yeah?
Yeah, I think he is. I don't think people usually connect these two. He has a lot in common with A.J. Preller. A.J. Preller has put a very nice coat of paint on a team that hasn't won a lot of playoff games. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's like smoke and mirrors and, you know, like there's nothing there. It's Adrian Preller is really good at finding some of the best young players in the world, finding them a little earlier than everyone else, whether it's trading for Fernando Tatis before the White Sox knew what they had, whether it's signing Ethan Salas, Leo DeVries, all these guys, getting them locked up years before other teams know that they're the top of the class, or being comfortable promising $5 million to a 14-year-old so that you can get him early. He's able and willing to do all that stuff. And I like met him when he was doing this with Texas like almost 20 years ago. So he has a long history of doing that. He makes a farm system. He is star focused in the same way Mike Rizzo is. He puts together big league teams that can sometimes seem like fantasy teams. I think he's now getting better at sort of filling out the roster and making a good bullpen as opposed to just getting like, you know, the lineup that'll win the offseason. And if you look at Jerry DePoto, he is much more analytically inclined, I think much more of a new age GM. So in that way, they're not the same in that AJ Preller is sort of the old school scouting gunslinger type. But DePoto now has a very good farm system, a very good scouting and development pipeline, a bunch of star players internally sort of created in the big leagues, similar to what Preller has, and just hasn't gotten the playoff wins yet. And so because DePoto isn't spending as much money as Preller did and doesn't have the wild expectations with giant contracts, I think he gets a little more rope to kind of figure out how to put these pieces together. I think a lot of times we think about those teams getting put together the way the Braves were, where just all of a sudden rookie of the year after rookie of the year, and then Albies and then Riley, and then all these guys show up and everyone's good and the whole team's great and they all sign extensions and win the division every year. Sometimes it's like this, whether it's San Diego or Seattle, maybe one of them wins the World Series in the next couple of years. Obviously, it's been a long time coming. But they have all the pieces in place. They're doing everything correctly. And then we'll find out. I think AJ Preller, now people are suspecting maybe he doesn't know how to put together a playoff team because that hasn't really been done yet. I don't know if we're there. But the evidence suggests we're getting there. And Jerry DePoto is at the beginning of that curve of, does he know how to put together a playoff team, or does he just know how to put together a top-to-bottom organization, which – you know, they said that about John Elway and Peyton Manning, and then they won the Super Bowl, and all of a sudden they didn't say it anymore. So I'm not even sure those are like real criticisms, in that that's just a thing they haven't done yet. But I think around the league, the Mariners are really respected for how well they have improved and gotten better at things that they weren't that good at a couple years ago. And I think they may start seeing the fruit of it coming up, because I don't think they've quite figured out how to make a really good lineup on a big league team with a smaller payroll. But in 2 years, I think all those guys will be homegrown, so I don't think they'll have that problem anymore.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. It's one of those things where, like, you've done the good job building the organization. Does that give you more runway to, you know, does DePoto get 5 more years to figure it out? Or, you know, do at some point you evaluate that those are different skill sets? Not that we have, you know, you can't, there's no control group. It's not like we can know for sure if those are distinctly different skill sets, or you just got to have the patience, especially with a lower budget team like the Mariners. Okay, want to pivot to back to the Jays a little bit, but this is more of a league-wide question. So the Jays, as we kind of outlined there, have a lot of work to do this offseason. The Yankees, if they were to lose Juan Soto, have a lot of work to do. They rank 12th in your core rankings. So still much better than the Jays, but a big Juan Soto question mark there. If you are a team that needs to add multiple impact pieces this offseason, let's assume for the sake of this conversation, Juan Soto stays in New York, whether with the Yankees or the Mets. How does this free agent market shape up in terms of, you know, the ability to go in and get two impact pieces, whether it's a hitter or a pitcher or one of each?
So the top free agent market is pretty good when it comes to starting pitching. Corbin Burns, I think, is clearly the best guy. It looks like he'll go for 200 to 250. And I guess like the hesitation is he'll be in his 30s starting next year. So are you sort of buying at the top of the market? And that's a lot of money, obviously. And then there's also Max Fried, who's also in his 30s, Jack Flaherty, who's going to be 29 next year. So you get, you know, slightly different variations of these sort of, you know, second or third starter. Burns, you could argue, is an ace. Those are the sort of guys on the free agent end. And then Blake Snell is sort of the wild card, who obviously was, you know, passed over by a lot of the for the price last offseason, started very slowly, and then has finished blazing hot. It's still the same dude he was last year when a lot of teams didn't want to commit to him, but he is also the sort of, he's the, you know, the lefty, the potential ace, but also might, you know, is the oldest of the group. And I think is seen as the guy that's going to age the poorest, which again is part of the reason he got sort of passed over last year. On the relief end, you got Jeff Hoffman, Tanner Scott, Carlos Estevez. You get a handful of sort of closer, like real closer types. We're talking 3, 4, 5 years at $15 million each year. So I think on the pitching end, you don't necessarily have like the $350 million Gerrit Cole or the Yamamoto. You also, by the way, have Roki Sasaki floating around who I think is probably worth at least $200 million. And if he comes over this year, won't be able to get more than five or six, similar to the Ohtani situation. Obviously, he can't hit like Ohtani, but is seen as maybe a better pitcher at the same stage as Ohtani. So pitching-wise, lots of options. Hitting-wise, not quite as good. Obviously, Juan Soto's there at the top. I think there's no more than three or four teams that are actually going to be bidding at the level at which he's going to want, which everybody thinks will go over $500 million. Alex Bregman, Willy Adames, I was going to say Matt Chapman, but he already signed, Ha-Seong Kim, Cody Bellinger, Pete Alonso. Those are all the like potential nine figure guys. And then beyond them, there's some Anthony Santander, Teoscar Hernandez, like some guys you'd like to have, but probably aren't going to get $100 million. So it's a little bit weaker on that end, but you've got infield and outfield. You got righties and lefties, you got power guys, you got, you know, hit first guys. So it's a pretty good free agent market where if you've got money to spend, the market's got plenty for what you want, with Rochy Sasaki being the big variable where you could sort of create $200 million in value if you happen to get him.
Yeah. So for anyone who doesn't remember the Shohei situation, how does the Rochy Sasaki situation work if he wants to come over right now? And like, what is that, you know, what does that look like if you're a team that decides, yeah, we want to be in on this? Obviously it's not about the dollar amount. Is it just, you're trying to sell him on your situation? He's kind of got his pick at the same price point.
Yeah, so the way that it works coming over from the MPB or the KBO is if you have a certain level of years of service in the league, which his got interrupted by COVID, it should have been next year, it's now going to be 2 years from now, then you can be the free and clear free agent like Yamamoto or all these various guys that have done that in the past. So he can't do that for two more years. So the thought would be if he comes now, he can do what Ohtani did, get the, you know, $3 to $5 million, make the minimum for the first 2 years and then be in arbitration for the next four and then hit free agency and potentially get the giant number. Whereas if he comes in 2 years, he would hit unrestricted free agency into his 30s, whereas now he would hit it in his late 20s. So if the thought is the big prize is at the end of the first contract, get there as soon as you can. And then also the other part is Ohtani, the buzz is he was literally making nine figures in off-field money. And so the thought is, oh, you'll lose $200 million, or maybe not 200. You'll lose $100 million maybe in those first 6 years, but you'll make it back in one good season off the field, and you get to that giant contract sooner. So the thought process is there's actually more money if you're the player you think you are coming over early. And so if this guy is seen as a 23-year-old guy who could turn into Yamamoto or Ohtani on the mound or Corbin Burns or Gerrit Cole, like all those things are on the table, but he also had his worst season in Japan this year. And there's some buzz of, is he beefing with the team, taking starts off? Is he actually hurt? Like there's some questions there. This isn't like a slam dunk. This guy's going to blow you away. But there's the chance that he can, and you would get ages 23 through 29, which is the years everybody wants. And so if he's just a fourth starter, he's still worth $200 million. Because you'd be get, like generally the way things work is if you're a third, fourth starter, you're basically worth $20 to $25 million, but nobody wants to pay free agents that money because they're 28, 29, 30. So you're paying for what they already did and hoping they do it into their mid 30s. So it's not the way anyone approaches normal free agents. That's how they would approach this level of free agent with this kind of talent at this kind of age. And he can't get more than anyone's international pool, which the pools only go up to $6 or $7 million. And most teams have already spent half their money. So he's probably just picking on what city he wants to go to the way Ohtani did. And it's probably only a couple $1 million. But like I outlined before, that money doesn't really matter. If it's $3 or $5 million, it doesn't make any difference to him, or it shouldn't.
Yeah. Well, you know, Toronto's a lovely city, Rochy Sasaki. And yeah, his down year where he has a 2.43 ERA and is still going to, you know, make 18 starts or so. It's that would be very, very interesting. Last one on the free agency side for you. You mentioned Anthony Santander as a sub $100 million guy. Obviously, he's going to be coming off of a very good season. He's already at 40 home runs. It'll be a 3+ win season. You know, I think typically if we saw a guy with that kind of baseball card line, I would have thought maybe that pushes into $100 million. Obviously, we look underneath and like, okay, well, he doesn't hit for good contact. The OBP is not very high. He's not a great corner outfielder. Is that where the hesitation would be? Like teams are sharper than to just pay for a 1 year home run outlier season?
Yeah, he's in a similar spot, not completely, but similar spot to Teoscar Hernandez was last year, where I think the suspicion was he'd get 3 or 4 years, roughly $15 million a year. Yuleski Gurriel got that deal. Teoscar wasn't getting the same number, so he then went for 1 year at $21 million with the Dodgers, and now he's in line to get that kind of deal he was looking for again in that like 50-ish million area. Santander is basically there, maybe a little ahead of it. Maybe he's at 4 years at $15 million a year for $60 million total. It's like somewhere around there. But that's the kind of player, the corner outfielder that doesn't offer a lot of speed and defense. The contact is just okay. It's more of a power and patience kind of guy that's going to be 30 next year and is a bit of a late bloomer, wasn't really that productive, was a Rule 5 pick earlier in his career. The industry looks at that guy, and I think we saw, you know, Chris Davis with the Orioles got like $170 million and then just immediately turned into a pumpkin. He was kind of like that, but was much better than Santander. That's like sort of the patron saint of, maybe they don't go nuts on this kind of guy. I mean, there's an argument with Pete Alonso, who has some things in common with Santander, that a bunch of people in the industry are like, this guy's worth $100 to $120 million, like below what Goldschmidt and Freddie Freeman got. They got $138 and $162. And the thought is, because it's the Mets, it's Steve Cohen, it's Pete Alonso, it's the Polar Bears, all these things, he's going to get 150 just because of like notoriety. And I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but if it happens, it's going to be because one or two owners decide they want to, not because that's what the industry thinks his value is. And Santander is that guy without being the Mets and the name and all that kind of stuff. He's like the generic version of almost the same guy. Obviously plays the outfield, not first base, but they offer a lot of the same stuff.
All right, I want to ask you about some young guys now instead of free agent guys. You ranked the best players in each age class from 16 to 25. By the way, this is I'm not going to ask you about this, but just a note for everyone that Vladimir Guerrero Jr. still shows up on these lists. That's how young Vlad is, 1 year from arbitration, still number one for the 1999 birth years. He didn't make the list, but I know you had tweeted about recently the kind of split season improvement for Jays prospect Arjun Namala, who just finished up. I did a thing on him on Blue Jay Central pregame last night, just finished up his A-ball season. The number two OP, he ended up finishing, even with the tough start, ended up finishing with the number two OPS in all of that league at the low A level there. And one of the best stat lines in all of baseball at any level for players 18 and under. What have you made of Namala's kind of, I guess, for lack of a better term, first half versus second half, even though it was really like first third versus second two thirds, him kind of starting to figure things out, at least from a results basis. How notable is that for you with a kid that young?
It's super important. If you look at like how I broke down some of the walk rate, strikeout rate, stuff like that, it's pretty obvious, even without going into the video or the deep stats. What happened was is he was being kind of passive and trying to get walks, and ended up getting behind in counts and started striking out a lot and hadn't seen this level of, you know, off-speed stuff and command and something. Like, he's still, like, 18 years old. Like, he should have been in this year's draft, but he was in the year before's draft, which is part of the reason teams draft guys based on age. And then you look at his numbers, and, like, his walk rate went down, but then his power went through the roof. And it was like, oh, sometimes, like, the belief a lot of people have is like, oh, you need to be patient, get good pitches to hit, sort of lay back and wait for your opportunity, and then you'll sort of reach your potential. In some cases, guys are too passive or hitting balls the other way or on the ground. And what they need to do is sort of turn into that, like, that softball player, the men's league softball player, where it's like, you just need to like be aggressive, find the first pitch you could hit, try to pull and lift everything. And it's like, there's guys like Kevin Millar where they made a lot of money and had a really good career just doing that. Like, maybe that's more the kind of guy he needs to be mentally to get to what he can do. And then the question would be, well, now if his walk rate is 5 or 6%, if that's the swing rate, and all of a sudden guys can throw the slider off the plate three times in a row, but very close to the zone, can he then make that adjustment there? He's now sort of in the game where I saw him early in the season when his stats were bad. He also looked awful. Like, he was just off balance. It looked as bad, if not worse, than the stats were. And then I watched a little bit of the video after he started turning it on, and it was like, oh, that's what, okay. Like, it has been night and day, which, again, when you have a 17-year-old playing against 21-year-olds, like, that's what you're going to get sometimes. And the fact that he figured it out at this level now shows me, all right, the odds he figures it out at the next level have dramatically increased from the guy I saw early in the year that I was, like, not going to give up on, but I was like, oh, boy, this could be really ugly, and he figured it out. So that's a really good sign for, is he going to figure it out at each subsequent level? In reality, there's probably one or two more times that he needs to figure it out. It's probably somewhere between high A and double A, and then there's another one that's probably triple A in the big leagues. Like, those are the really big jumps in quality where it's a different kind of pitching. And so that's the thing to watch, is if he's hitting in double A like this next year, then I think the odds that he's like an everyday player are now better than 50-50. And if he's got a 35% strikeout rate at high A next year, then we're like, okay, he passed one challenge. We're not positive he's got the other one in him, but let's see what he can do.
Yeah, that's well said, and I appreciate that insight. Kylie, I know you got to bounce here. Thanks so much for taking the time out, man.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Kylie McDaniel of ESPN. Yeah, Arjun Namala just wrapped up a very good season. Again, I broke it down on Jay Central last night, but here's a crazy stat about, I know it's low A, so like the thought is that everyone is young down there. But Arjun Namala was so young as a draft prospect that not only was the average pitcher he faced 3 years older than him, he had one plate appearance all season against a pitcher younger than him. That's it. Every other plate appearances was against an older and more experienced pitcher. So pretty incredible for him to finish second in the Florida State League in OPS overall, finished with 40 extra base hits at that level. It's encouraging stuff. A long way to go, obviously, from low A Dunedin to the major leagues. It's going to take a couple years. It's going to be a while, but wouldn't be shocked to see him start the year at high A Vancouver next year to keep challenging him, given how aggressive they were challenging him with the Dunedin placement to start this year. So yeah, fun, encouraging stuff. Jay is back in action at 3 o'clock today, Bowden Francis against Sean Manaea. We'll break some of that down for you. Also had a question in the text line from Greg and Peter Aboro. How much faith do you have in the Blue Jays development system to elevate prospects to MLB ready? Not sure if that was for Kylie or for me. I mean, the way this is worded is tough because, like, elevate to MLB ready, you know, that if we're talking about, hey, do they use the Buffalo Bisons well as a finishing school to get guys? Yeah, I mean, I think you look at what's happened with Horwitz, with Clement, with Barger, you know, Nathan Lucas, a guy who comes up and you know, is able to, you know, look like a professional hitter, you know, right out of the gate. Kind of, and I get Nathan Lucas is 30 or whatever, but I'm just going through the examples of guys who have come up and looked more like looked fairly ready, having come through AAA. That finishing school approach, yeah, I think that's reasonable. Matt Hague did a good job with those guys last year, and we saw a couple of them come up and contribute. They did a good job with some of them this year. They come up and contribute. But the larger problem system-wide is that, you know, are you able to get those guys to that level and there is a floor and a limited ceiling? Are you not identifying the highest upside guys? I don't know. It's something we have to dig in on a little deeper. I don't think it's a, hey, they're struggling to get them ready for the major leagues aspect, because a lot of these guys have come up and looked pretty good. Like, obviously you're going to struggle at some point. Every hitter pretty much in the history of baseball has come up, and even if they started great, you know, pitchers adjust. And I mean, Julio Rodriguez had to figure it out. Corbin Carroll's had to figure it out. Mike Trout had to figure it out. Like, pretty much everyone has to go through that. But they, you know, the guys have come up and looked ready in the case of a Horwitz, a David Schneider last year, and Ernie Clement, Nathan Lucas, who pick your guy. Most of the guys have come up and look ready. Barger less so earlier in the year, but he was also up a little earlier than maybe anticipated. So I don't think it's a finishing school kind of issue. It's more of a, you know, when you're talking about the upside in the system, it's finding and targeting those upside guys like Arjun Namala, who stands out. You know, he you look at the type of prospects they have in the system, he is unique. And that's what kind of makes him exciting and why we've talked about him a bunch on the show, in addition to the strong play down at the Dunedin level. Malcolm and Guelph had asked, do you trust Bo will bounce back from this season? Can he get back to the level he was at? I mean, I don't really see why not. Bo's an interesting one because, you know, even when he's been good in the past, it's with an atypical profile that's chase heavy and he doesn't take a lot of walks and things like that. He expands the zone a lot. So that has always made him a bit of a tough guy to evaluate. And even when he was struggling this year, at least early on when it was only like a couple weeks of struggle, it was hard to diagnose because you don't want to tell Bo Bichette to not be Bo Bichette to try to fix some of the issues. Having said that, in general, I will bet on the guy who had five seasons of hitting 290 or better, figuring it out. Like, he led the American League in hits a couple times. Again, five seasons in a row, the first five seasons of his career. And I know two of those were tiny seasons, but they were also tiny seasons as like a 21-year-old. He hit 290 or better every single time before this year. So, you know, maybe he's not a 140 WRC plus, you know, mega star, but a guy who can hit for average, absolutely. I think that skill will come back. Let's take a break. When we come back on the other side, we'll talk to Disha Thosar, Fox Sports, about this Mets team. We'll get you set for Bowden Francis against Sean Manaea, which is the matchup today. We might get Jay's lineups at some point as well. We don't have them just yet. Sean Manaea, by the way, another one of these guys with just crazy extension down the mound. So yesterday we saw 6'6" David Peterson from the left side getting way down the mound, and it's kind of an unconventional delivery point. Well, Sean Manaea is only 6'5", but he gets even greater extension down the mound. He is also a lefty. So the Jays saw some of it yesterday. Manaea also a weird one to figure out. He's also, you know, again, similar to Peterson yesterday, some of the success he'd had has been due to keeping the ball on the ground. Manaea throws a sinker about 41% of the time. He also throws a four-seamer and a cutter. So he's one of these guys that throw, hey, my fastball is not super elite. Let me throw three of them. And I throw it from the left side. And I have two breaking balls and an off-speed pitch. Just a funky guy. He is in the 99th percentile in run value off his fastballs so far this year. So basically, there are few people throwing their fastball more effectively than him, which is, not what you'd maybe expect, given that it's a 93-mile-an-hour, 92-mile-an-hour sinker. So that type of guy has given everyone's given the Jays some trouble this year, although the Jays are, like, the best offense in baseball over the last couple weeks. Some quality competition stuff there. Some, hey, you've got lefties that hit against righties now. Anyway, all this is to say Sean Manaea has had a very, very good season, and he is an atypical pitcher. The Jays got to one of those yesterday as well. Should be a fun one. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Disha Thosar about it on the other side as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
The most opinionated Maple Leaf show out there. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. 307 start today. The old work from dome as Sean Manaea takes on Bowden Francis. Bowden Francis, a story well told at this point. Five starts in a row of six innings or longer, including a four-start stretch that broke modern records for lowest whip. And, hey, no one's had game scores like this as a Blue Jay since Roy Halladay and things like that. This Mets team has not seen Bowden Francis for a single plate appearance, unless it was in the minors that we don't have the numbers for. The Jays have seen Sean Manaea a little bit more, though. Manaea's obviously bounced around the league a little bit. So 57 plate appearances against Sean Manaea. However, 43 of those belong to George Springer. George Springer knows Sean Manaea incredibly well. He's 13 for 39 against him career. So 333 batting average with a homer and a couple of walks. The rest of the Jays, not much of a sample against Manaea. Varsho's 0 for 6. Kirk's 0 for 3. Ernie Clement's 0 for 1. And Vlad's 2 for 3 against them with a strikeout. So some familiarity there, but not a ton. The Jays are pretty familiar with the Mets hitters at this point, including MVP candidate Francisco Lindor, who made some noise early in yesterday's game and just having a banger of a season. Our next guest, Disha Thosar of Fox Sports, wrote a banger of an article on Francisco Lindor. Disha, how are you?
I'm great. How are you guys?
Doing well. So Francisco Lindor, unlikely given where his relationship with the fan base had been for the first little bit of this contract. King of New York now. What's going on?
Yeah, I think it's way overdue. I think he's kind of been waiting for this moment since the season that he signed in 2020, right after the pandemic. His first year, 2021, with the Mets, expectations were high, a little bit too high, I think, because of that contract, but warranted because of course, the city he's playing in. I think within the clubhouse and in the organization, that was kind of a given that this kind of season was going to happen eventually. His teammates were definitely patient. The organization, ownership beyond patient. I think that goes a long way with someone like Lindor, just having that faith from Steve Cohen, Alex Cohen, who's Puerto Rican too. So they have that connection. And I think that kind of just building up on itself year after year is what has allowed now Francisco Lindor to kind of set that background for what he's doing on the field, which has been incredible now for a couple of seasons. It is, of course, his best season since being with the Mets, but it's not that different. He really has been on fire since 2022, and I think that's kind of where that recognition piece is coming into play now.
Yeah, you called him in your piece the most underappreciated player in baseball, and I think that's fair. You know, his fifth 30 home run season, I think it's his seventh time hitting 20 or more. Like, this is a guy who's been at this level, and like, he's going to have like a 7 or 8 win season this year, but he's done that before when he was with Cleveland as well. So, I mean, obviously there was the Shohei 50-50 chase, and I don't know, we could do the MVP stuff. We've done it a bunch. I'm sure everyone's done it. That level though of league wide recognition and kind of putting Francisco Lindor back as the, you know, back in the discussion as a superstar, the way he was when he was first coming up. Do you think we're back there now or getting there in terms of, hey, everyone remember to appreciate Francisco Lindor?
Yeah, I think we're sort of in a better place with his sort of national conversation. Because if you think about it, this is some of the research I was doing, even when he was with Cleveland, he was a little overrated at that time. It was, the topic was, oh, well, he's just playing on a Cleveland team that sure gets, has a winning record every year, but they're not in the same league as some of these other teams that always get into the playoffs. And of course, he's going to get that all-star vote every year on the Cleveland team for being their best player. So it went from he's overrated to now underappreciated. And now I think this season it's kind of leveling out. What's interesting about all of that is still, why? Why does he have sort of these tags attached to him one way or the other? And there's something about, I think, of course, we've seen positivity, even just having that kind of stable and consistency. Signing that $341 million contract doesn't help. But beyond that, I think there's just factors that have always kind of rubbed people the wrong way with Francisco Lindor. That is kind of finally, I think, now evening out to, listen, this is just a superstar in the game, one of the most underappreciated players. And what goes back to his all-star stump this year, I think people forget when he was snubbed, sure, he didn't make it by fan voting. Not much of a surprise because of his history with Mets fans. He didn't get off to a good start. He did get snubbed by the commissioner's office, but what's included in there is player voting. And he also got snubbed by players in the league. So I think this goes beyond, right, just his organization being overlooked by MLB because it's the Mets, the LOL Mets. It also is sort of this conversation even among his peers. So I think after this season, that might start getting leveled out. I think it's been way overdue.
So I know he told you in that piece that, you know, hey, his attitude about like what will the legacy be or the contract, you know, that's going to come down to championships and if they have playoff success and things like that. But the reception from Mets fans, the MVP chance he's gotten in New York now, given where things have come from, how much do you think that's meant to him? Or did you get the sense of, you know, that meaning a lot to him over the course of this season?
I don't think he's there yet. This okay. kind of surprised me. I did think it would kind of be at that spot where this means a lot to me. What was interesting was neither him, I also spoke to his wife, Katia, neither of them mentioned that the fans gave them a standing ovation, gave Lindor a standing ovation in April in the midst of his slump. They kind of, Mets fans took a page out of Trey Turner's book and tried to lift him up in that way. That is, I can't overstate how insane that is for New York. That does not happen here. And I mean, good for the crowd for trying a different thing. And it definitely worked eventually. But even that, I think Lindor is very head down, day to day in the grind. Maybe some of this will impact him in the off season, but I think truly it will be more meaningful down the line of how much they are supporting him now is just hard to tell after I think you get off to the start that you did with the fan base. Same with his wife, Katia. She is still, talking to her about that first year with the Mets, it's like she remembers it like it was yesterday. And I think it is a bit traumatic when you're not expecting that and coming from a Cleveland team where the fans just do not treat you like that at all. It is kind of very happy-go-lucky. Even if you have an 0-for-20 stretch, it's fine. So I think it is going to take both of them some time to get more of this support, more of these types of MVP seasons. And then maybe looking back, it'll mean a lot more to him that the fans had him throughout this stretch after a few years in New York.
I'm sure too, there's an element, and maybe this is an unspoken element. It's not even something he or anyone could verbalize, but you know, they're in the middle of a wild card race here too. And how much do you want to, you know, appreciate it? Like that is, we're talking about bigger picture stuff, end of year reflection stuff, and they're in the middle of a wild card race. So maybe he just wants to, you know, keep exactly. the focus. Although I guess his wife doesn't need to keep the focus on the wild card race. But
exactly. Yeah, she gets to kind of focus on that all the time, 24/7.
Yeah. With respect to this wild card race, so the Jays beat them yesterday, Atlanta, San Diego, Arizona win. This is going to come right down to the wire. It feels like that final series, or not final series, but final week of the season between the Mets and the Braves. How do you feel about how this is shaping up? And I guess Arizona and San Diego are in that conversation too, since they're not too far removed from Atlanta and New York.
Yeah, I think definitely the Mets are a sleeper pick. I think many people in the industry and even talking to scouts are kind of not looking at that pitching staff as what it's been recently. And they've really stepped it up to stabilize. Yesterday, was really not a good start from Peterson, but he was in that conversation of he has to be on it in order for the Mets to get where they want to go. But even beyond that, there's Kodai Senga potentially coming back. He could be in the bullpen helping them out down the stretch. So the pieces are there. The offense has to also perform at its max. The whole part of this Lindor being underappreciated piece is that he carries the team. When he was in a slump for the first month of the season, the Mets also were not performing well. So he's starting to come out of it in this series against the Jays. He's getting back to what had made him so hot in this whole second half. And in that way, I think when all things are clicking for this team, there's this underlying belief in that clubhouse. They know exactly where they want to go. They're not afraid to say the words World Series. It's funny, like covering the Yankees, who right now are first in the AL East. They go back and forth with the Orioles. They're obviously going to be in the playoffs. They don't utter those two words. I think they know what would happen if they even said, oh, we're a championship team, because they're really, they have times where they're not playing like it. The fan base has been back and forth on how the strength of that team is. But with the Mets, it's just this sort of quiet focus. Like, this is what we're going to do. They remind me a lot of last year's Diamondbacks and the 2019 Nationals, of that overlooked team where they're quietly just sticking to business. So yeah, I think they have a real shot of getting right past the Braves. I think it is that part of it is going to come a little back and forth right down to the wire, but that's what makes it exciting, right?
Yeah, it'll be a heck of a series that final week there. And I know Mets fans have some trauma about going into Atlanta in September for certain things. So we'll see how that goes. Yeah, and then the Yankees are going, I mean, this is Canada. This is like not only do you not touch the Stanley Cup, you don't touch the conference championship, like their version of the ALCS championship. You don't even touch that. But you don't talk about it either. So the Yankees are going that route. With respect to the Yankees, I know you wrote about this before Jason Dominguez got the call up. And, you know, like a lot of us, you were kind of like, come on, guys. Like, really? Why now? What do you make of them? Hey, 8-9 days later being like, yeah, now's the time for Jason Dominguez.
Yeah, I knew that this was going to happen. I even mentioned it in that column. Like, when they do call him up eventually this season, it's going to be fair to question whether they're doing it because of his service time, because of the fan pressure, because of the media pressure, and because nothing was turning around with Verdugo. I think it's pretty silly for Brian Cashman to say Verdugo gives us our best chance at winning, and then the day that Dominguez is called up, Verdugo's batting ninth and Dominguez is batting sixth. The next day, Verdugo's not even in the lineup. So they knew exactly how much of an improvement the Martian would be over what they've been trotting out in left field. The fact that it took them this long, I think there's too many cooks in the kitchen. I think there are just way too many opinions coming from the human element, which, let's just say, that's Aaron Boone, who has to have the pulse on the clubhouse, the pulse on the media, the questions he gets asked every day. And then going to the analytics side of really who is going to give us the best shot. I think they're just overthinking this. And what even goes beyond Dominguez's impact? Sure, he's going to take a little bit to get used to major league pitching, but isn't it valuable for your top prospect to hang around Aaron Judge and Juan Soto? And Juan Soto, who's not even promised to be in the Bronx next season, to learn what he can from him, grasp whatever he will. I think they really are overlooking just some of the human elements of what it means to call up your top prospect. And they lost a really easy gimme when they could have just called him up on September 1st. And then for a week, their fan base was against him. And a lot of attention was placed on Dominguez in that week. Now he knows that the fan base is waiting on him to do something big. So they made a few bad decisions, bad mistakes. Now he's finally up. Verdugo is going to get less playing time. DJ LeMay, who's on the IL. These are things that should have happened months ago, but it is finally happening. So sure, give them credit for that, but they're way, way, way overdue.
Yeah, it's an awkward one. I mean, the Verdugo thing, you wrote about this, like the stubbornness around the Verdugo stuff and admitting he wasn't playing well was kind of weird. And, you know, then he's not hustling out balls and they're making excuses for it, et cetera. And then, yeah, I think that's a great point that sometimes gets overlooked, is letting your top prospect absorb from guys like Judge and Soto and how those guys do their business. Or Verdugo, if you love Verdugo so much, you know, let him see how Verdugo goes about his work and all the grit stuff and everything. You know, the extra 8 plate appearances over 2 weeks that he would have got at AAA, maybe not the biggest of deals comparatively. Yeah, winning is a part of development. Being in an independent race is good for learning. Okay, elsewhere with the Yankees, this was a couple pieces back, but in one of the roundtables you guys do at Fox Sports, you had mentioned Luis Gil as one of your non-ace X factors down the stretch here. What are you looking for from Gil for this Yankees team, especially now that we know, you know, it's going to be Cortes maybe who goes to the bullpen the odd time, not necessarily Gil, which is maybe what people expected, you know, earlier in the year.
Yeah, it's funny. I just spoke to Nestor Cortes about this yesterday, sort of what's happening with those quotes ever since you said you're pissed about going to the bullpen. Has your mind changed? And he was like, no, I'm still pissed. And hopefully I'm not the odd man out. Like when it comes to October, I still want to be in that rotation. So that fire has been missing definitely from the Yankees. I think it can have a ripple effect as far as Gil and what I wrote about him being sort of that non-A's X factor. He stepped up for the Yankees when Gerrit Cole was on the IL. Now I'm interested to see what this rotation looks like with Gerrit Cole, who, mind you, his past 7 starts has had a sub-2 ERA. That's going fully under the radar. He looks like Cy Young Gerrit Cole. He's not getting as much run support as he could enjoy in all of his starts. I think that would really put him over the top. The Yankees just need Cole to be Cole. And then for these guys that had surprise seasons, like Gil, to fall in line. And then another sleeper underneath for that rotation is Rodon. When we were talking about this big season for the Yankees in the beginning of the season, it was about that 1-2 punch of Cole and Rodon. Now we're seeing, will that punch be Cole and Gil? That would be pretty wild. No one expected that to happen. I think if Gil's not going in the bullpen, I could see maybe Clark Schmidt potentially is coming back from IL. Maybe he could help out in relief. He's already done that before in his career. So the pitching actually low-key is in a good spot for the Yankees. It's not being talked about for valid reasons. I think the offense has really big question marks. The defense has really not looked good. So in that way, I think we know pitching rules October. So they're in a good spot. They just need to really fix some of these other holes with their offense.
Last one before I let you go here. So the Orioles and Yankees, neither seems to want the division. Some question marks on either side. The Astros don't have the record that those teams have. They're not going to get the bye through the first round. But if we go back and looked at from the point that the Astros were 10 games back in the division to now, they've been the best team in the American League. Where do they stack up relative to the Yankees and Orioles to you? Do they have a case as one of the more dangerous teams in the American League field?
Yeah, definitely. And I still don't think that this Yankees team has proven to me that they can cross that bridge and beat the Astros in the ALCS. This is all going to be for naught if, again, they're just stopped by Houston in the same place they've been every year in the playoffs. And it is a little, I mean, it's interesting. This Astros team has shown some vulnerability. We don't know how Tucker will be coming back from IL. Justin Verlander, he's not looking so hot. They have a big decision to make whether they want to even include him in their postseason rotation or if he'll be in long relief. So there are some troubling dynamics, some troubling narratives, but overall, this is still a solid Houston Astros team. There's no reason to doubt them. They've proven everything in their last few years of going that deep, even in the playoffs. So they're a huge threat this year. Sure, they're a little bit of a quieter threat just because of their injuries and a little of their question marks. But I think this is going to come down to, have the Yankees done enough to beat them in the ALCS? I'm not so sure. I think they have a lot of defensive problems that can really hurt you in the playoffs. And Yordan Alvarez for the Astros can change the game with one swing, of course. So can Judge. So can Juan Soto. I'm looking forward to what Soto will do in October. So it's going to be interesting. This is the best chance the Yankees have had with this lineup. It's the best lineup in a few years since they've lost to the Astros in the ALCS. So I think it's neck and neck right now between those two.
Well, it should be a lot of fun to see assuming the Astros get out of the wild card round two and we get one of those matchups. But yeah, someone's not going to win the AL East and they're going to be in a wild card matchup too. Disha, thanks so much for taking the time out. As much as it puts a lot on your plate, I hope you're headed for double New York playoff baseball here.
Oh, hell yeah. I can't wait. I will be there.
Thanks, Disha. Disha Thosar of Fox Sports. All right. Let's Jays, Mets, at 3 o'clock today to round out this series. 307 start Bowden Francis against Sean Manaea. We got you ready for those two a little earlier. No lineups just yet, but keep an eye out for those. Obviously, we'll have a pregame leading you into that as well. Blair and Barker will be with you after the game as usual. Yeah, we got a minute for these texts in the text line. Alex in Cambridge said, asked, what do you need to see from Yariel to solidify a starting spot for next season? Honestly, I don't think you could solidify it. Like, he's going to pitch 9 or 10 innings the rest of the way, probably. That's not going to be enough. It's about the offseason work. It's about how he looks in spring training after having, built up this year after not pitching at all last year. I don't think they're in a spot where they could come into next year with, hey, these are the starting rotation spots locked in. They need depth anyway. They need to address the bullpen. So whether that's adding fringe guys, and if they lose out on the rotation battle, you could bump to the pen. This is not to be negative about Yariel. I really like him. I like the signing at the time. I like the season that he's had. But in terms of solidifying a starting spot for next year, I don't think the Jays are in a position to be giving those out based on, you know, a change in opinion over the last 10, 12 innings here. All right, there are a couple of those left over. We'll save them for later in the week because we got to go. It's Bowden Francis against Sean Manaea at 3:07 today. Thank you to Dan Schulman, Ben Clemens, Kylie McDaniel, and Disha Thosar for joining us. Thank you, as always, to Amit Mann, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Can Bowden keep it rolling? I hope so. Work from Dome Day. Hope you guys enjoy it. Hope you have a wonderful Wednesday, and we will talk to you at 10 a.m. tomorrow to break it all down.